Welcome to the Mental Minute, an AI-generated podcast. Ever feel like you see what you expect to see?
Yeah, that's a common thing.
Well, today we're diving into something related. The observer expectancy effect. It's this kind of sneaky phenomenon.
Right, where a researcher's own biases, their expectations, can unintentionally influence the people they're studying.
Exactly. And it can seriously skew experiment results, can it? It messes with the internal validity.
It absolutely can. So, yeah, we should unpack how this bias works and maybe more importantly, how researchers try to, you know, control it.
Okay. So where does this connect with things people might already know, like confirmation bias?
Ah, good connection. It's deeply related. Confirmation bias is that tendency we all have to look for information that confirms what we already believe.
Right. We favor evidence that fits our ideas.
Exactly. And for a researcher, this can mean, maybe unconsciously, focusing on data that supports their hypothesis.
And maybe ignoring data that doesn't quite fit.
Precisely. Or even just interpreting ambiguous results in a way that leans towards their expectation. It can lead to, well, misinterpretations.
Okay, so it's not usually about deliberate cheating, like faking data.
Not necessarily, no. Often it's much more subtle than that. Experimenters can unintentionally give off cues, signals.
Signals to the participants.
Yeah, about how they're sort of expected to behave. These are sometimes called demand characteristics.
How does that happen? Like, what kind of cues?
Oh, it could be anything, really. The way they phrase instructions, maybe their tone of voice, even subtle body language.
Yeah.
Things the experimenter might not even be aware they're doing.
You mentioned an example before we started, something about a horse that really illustrates this.
Whoa, absolutely. Clever Hans. He was quite the sensation back in the early 1900s.
Clever Hans. Okay. What was his story?
Well, his owner claimed Hans could do arithmetic, tell time, things like that. Really impressive mental feats for a horse.
Okay, I'm skeptical already.
And you should be.
Yeah.
But initially, investigators, including a psychologist named Carl Stumpf, were actually pretty convinced it wasn't just a simple trick or fraud.
Really? Why?
Because Hans seemed to get the answers right, even when his owner wasn't the one asking the questions.
So wait, maybe the horse was a genius.
That's what it looked like. But then Stumpf's assistant, a guy named Oscar Fungst, decided to dig a bit deeper, more systematically.
Okay, the plot thickens. What did Fungst find?
This is where it gets fascinating. Fungst discovered two key things. First, Hans could only answer correctly if the person asking the question could actually see him.
All right, condition one.
And second, crucially, Hans only got it right if the questioner themselves knew the correct answer.
Ah, so if the questioner didn't know the answer.
Hans didn't know it either. Suddenly he wasn't so clever.
Okay, so hold on. The horse wasn't doing math at all, was he?
Not a bit of it. Fungst watched the questioners like a hawk. He noticed these tiny, almost invisible changes in their posture, their facial expressions. Right as Hans, who tapped his hoof for answers, approached the correct number, the questioner would unconsciously tense up slightly, maybe lean forward just a fraction, make a tiny facial movement.
And then relax when he hit the right number.
Exactly. Hans was incredibly perceptive. He learned to read these minute cues from the humans as the signal to stop tapping.
Wow. So the humans were unintentionally cueing the horse. It wasn't about the horse's brain power, but about unconscious human behavior.
Precisely. A perfect example of the observer expectancy effect. The questioners expected Hans to stop at the right number, and they unintentionally told him when to do it.
That's an amazing story, but does this apply to, you know, people too, not just horses?
Oh, absolutely. It's not just some historical quirk. Mm-hmm. Think about a study where researchers had people rate photos, portrait pictures.
Okay.
They had subjects estimate the success potential of the person in the photo. Now, there are two groups of experimenters running these sessions.
Right.
One group of experimenters was subtly led to expect that the subjects would give generally positive ratings. High success potential.
And the other group?
They were led to expect negative ratings. Low success potential.
But the photos and the task were identical for everyone involved. The actual participants rating the photos.
Exactly the same. The only difference was the experimenter's expectation.
And the result.
The findings were pretty stark. The group where the experimenters expected positive ratings, they gave significantly more optimistic appraisals. Higher success ratings.
Wow. So the experimenter's expectations somehow transferred to the participants' judgments.
That was the conclusion. The experimenters must have conveyed their expectations through, again, subtle, probably unconscious cues, tone, maybe slight nods, who knows. And the subjects picked up on it and, well, complied.
That has huge implications, doesn't it? Think about medicine or education.
Huge. A doctor's belief in a new drug could subtly influence how they perceive a patient's improvement. Or a teacher's expectation about a student that could genuinely affect how the student performs.
So this bias is everywhere. How do researchers actually guard against it? What's the solution?
Well, the most robust safeguard is using what's called a double-blind technique.
Double-blind. Okay, how does that work?
It's quite straightforward conceptually. In a double-blind study, neither the participants nor the experimenters interacting with them know who is in which group.
So like in a drug trial, neither the patient nor the doctor giving the pill knows if it's the real drug or a placebo.
Exactly. That way, the experimenter's expectations about the drug's effectiveness, or lack thereof, simply can't influence how they interact with the patient or how they record the outcomes. It removes that channel for bias.
Makes sense. Now, what about just collecting more data? Doesn't bias sort of average out if you have enough measurements? Something about the central limit theorem?
That's a common misunderstanding. The central limit theorem works beautifully when errors or variations are random and independent.
Okay.
But observer bias often isn't random. It can be systematic. If an experimenter's expectation consistently nudges every measurement slightly in one direction,
then averaging more measurements gives you a more precise average of the biased result.
You got it. You're just zeroing in on the wrong answer with more confidence. The bias is correlated across the measurements, so averaging doesn't eliminate it.
Right. Okay. That's a critical point. It's not just about quantity. It's the quality and the method of collection.
Absolutely. The takeaway here is really how powerful and how subtle our own expectations can be. They can act like these invisible filters, you know, shaping how we perceive reality, even when we're genuinely trying to be objective.
So it really highlights why things like double blinding are so crucial for reliable research.
Vital across pretty much all fields where observation or interaction is involved.
So to sum up, even with the best intentions, our expectations can unintentionally warp what we observe or the results we get. Understanding this is key.
It really is. And maybe it prompts a thought for you, the listener. Where might your own expectations be subtly shaping your interactions or observations in everyday life? It's something to ponder.
Definitely something to think about. That's all for this episode. Thanks for tuning in.